have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
On today's episode, I have Dirk Armbrust, Managing Director at the Vant Group. Dirk, welcome to the Business Broker Growth Show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I am super excited. So for people tuning in, they can obviously check out the show notes. They can find you online. We'll have your links, everything in the show notes. We'll mention them at the end as well. But for people who aren't familiar with you, so you are a business leader, strong executive leadership skills, and built a foundation of operations, M&A, sales management, financial analysis, supply chain, all of that stuff. And then with being a part of the Vant Group, focusing on helping business owners exit, obviously that's what you're here for. That's what we're here for. And I'm excited because you've been doing this for quite some time in the space. I don't know what a lot of experience in the M&A business broker, you know, realm is. I don't know. Where do you have that line when you're like, somebody's been doing this for a bit longer?
Oh, man, that's a great question. Yeah, because you kind of mentioned the stuff that I did. I spent the first half of my career in operations, supply chain, manufacturing, and then kind of got into M&A, you know, the latter half of my career. And I'll say this, you know, I learn new stuff every day, but I think kind of the sweet spot before you really got, you know, some really good experience under your belt and you can credibly go into any situation, man, that's going to be between 5 and 8 years, I think. So, and I'm currently at about 10 with the Vant Group.
Interesting side note, obviously not planned and not what we're talking about. Anyone that's familiar with the book Outliers from Malcolm Gladwell, that's the where the 10,000 hours principle comes in.
Yes.
One thing I noticed early on in professional life when I was in the mortgage industry is when I would look at the mortgage guide every month, the top companies and top individuals were always in the 7 to 10 plus year range. And then that book came out, Outliers, and I realized like it's about 7 to 10 years of focused effort, 40 hours a week, in order to master something and really become skilled at it. And so that makes sense, right? So after, you know, 8 to 10 years, you've had enough at bats, you've probably been punched in the face a lot, you've worked your way through a lot of transactions, you've seen a lot of things go sideways and bring it back and find ways to just always keep going where that puts you in that category.
Yeah, 100%. And also, I mean, you know, that get punched in the face and keep going, that's good for clients too, because that M&A process of getting through till close, stuff comes up, you know, and you have to kind of be an amateur psychologist to your client when like, oh my gosh, this bad thing happened. What do we do? Okay, we just, you know, go around it and keep moving, you know?
Yeah, fascinating. There's another thing, again, it's always fun. And I always enjoy chatting with you because who knows where the conversation's going to go. There's another definition of a master, which is a master is not somebody who never makes a mistake, but a master is someone who, when they make a mistake or mistakes happen, they actually turn that into something better than it was originally going to be. So think of like a master woodworker. There's a mistake or something wrong with the wood and they turn that into some amazing feature that was better than intended. And I think to your point, like as a master, you know, business broker, M&A broker in this context where something comes up and you get through it even better than you were going to.
Yeah, 100%. You just reminded me. So our founding partner, our managing partner is Alex Vantarakis, and that's where the name of the Vant Group comes from. And years ago, he made the comment like, hey, I never learned how to do things without doing them wrong the first time. You know. And by the way, that's a good boss to have. You know.
Yeah. Hopefully, very empathetic when it's your turn to be new, right? And everyone who's doing something for the first time, they got to learn some way. Obviously, the challenge is you're helping someone exit a business in a way that they've never done before. It's probably their first and only time they're doing it, and so you got to make sure you know what you're doing because otherwise, the results are very difficult.
Right? Yeah, you know, and that's another good point too. Because when I'm talking to sellers, you know, about selling their business, I say, look, you know, people make mistakes in business all the time. You know, you make a bad hire. Gee whiz, it costs a lot of money. You burn 6 months bringing in a new person, but you can kind of recover from it. If you make a bad deal, there's no mulligans. You know, the business is no longer yours. It's got to be done right. As painful, you know, as the process may be, the end result has to be right.
Yeah, there's some things. in life where it's, you really just have that one shot, right? It needs to be as well done and perfect as possible. Like that's it. You, like you said, no mulligans. So when you look back at your career, right, pre M&A and what you did, operations, supply chain management, all of that, where did that really help you in this mode? Because I see some people who get into M&A, business brokers, right, using those terms interchangeable as like the whole umbrella of it, where they had a business, they ran a business, they were a business owner, other ones who worked in businesses, other ones who said, hey, I know, I'll just buy a franchise of a business brokerage because I like to make money and I'm young. And so now I'm a business broker, right? So like for you, how did that prepare you so you could have these conversations and facilitate?
Oh yeah, transactions? I mean, great question. Yeah, because you know, I do see people like, hey, you know, I went to Wharton, you know, so now I'm an M&A advisor because I know everything. It's like, okay, that's true. So just in general, life experiences do give you some seasoning because, you know, M&A deals, there's a ton of things that can go bad. You know, there's deal killers. You know, as a side note, every deal seems like it dies once and can you revive it? So there's that general seasoning. But back to what your question. So a business owner puts a ton of trust in their M&A advisor. You know, it's like, you know, not only do you understand your craft of selling and getting me the best value, but do you really understand enough of my businesses, my challenges? And so having that operational background, you know, I could understand supply chain things in their business. I could understand working capital, inventory, manufacturing processes, sales, all those things helps me do a better job of understanding their business even before going into market. And so it does help, you know, kind of get that trust, you know, from sellers before they decide to engage with us. And I think it helps getting them through the process. You know, if a buyer is trying to attack, you know, the current value of the business, even if they've already agreed to the value, it's like, hey, well, there's this issue. Hopefully I know enough about whatever area already. And then having done the deep analysis up front, you know, we can withstand those withering attacks on the, you know, those after LOI negotiations, if you will.
Yeah. Curious about that because the after LOI negotiations, I know there's times.
By the way, that's not supposed to be a thing.
I know it's not supposed to be a thing. It's not actually that. We, in no way do we want to like legitimize that and make that an official part, right? Like once you have a deal that you've everyone's agreed on, it should just be the deal. However, there's two circumstances I could see where it happens. One is where as they're going through their due diligence, the business is not performing currently like it was in whatever was prepared in the past, right? Like the owner's slipping, things are changing, clients lost, concentration is difficult. And then there's the buyer feels like they could just negotiate something after. What do you see percentage-wise? What do you see as like any trends in those two buckets?
Okay. And when you're asking for a percentage, you mean, you know, the size of that pie chart is deals where there's something tries to change after LOI. So right. Within that pie chart. Yeah, I think a very small sliver of them, maybe sliver is too small. A small chunk is, hey, I just want to renegotiate the deal. You know, certainly those things pop up. We try to screen that before we get to the LOI stage, but always being ready for it, you know, so, you know, anticipate areas where somebody may try to renegotiate or retrade the deal and already be anticipating what those vulnerabilities are and have an answer for them. Now, the bigger chunk of that subset of where deals are tempted to, to change after LOI, it's to your point, something happened, you know, business dropped off, you know, key employees quit, some customer quit and things of that nature. So it's kind of a two-step thing. You know, if the buyer kind of comes to me or comes to me and the seller and says, hey, I want a different price because this X thing happened, you know, try to defend against it as much as possible, understand it, have a very quick opinion on what it should mean in terms of a change in value. So we're not, you know, negotiating against ourselves on a change the buyer is asking for that's not legitimate. But let's say there is a legitimate case like, hey, this thing needs to be different. Then the conversation has to go back to the seller. It's like, okay, the buyer's asking for this reduction because of this thing that happened. I don't like it, you know, but it's something that we should consider. And often the seller will like, well, I'm not going to do it. You know, he said he was going to pay this much. We're not retrading the deal. Kick him out. You know, let's go back to market. It's like, well, understand when we go back to market, that customer that quit is still quit. You know, so, you know, and it's helping sellers through a very stressful, very emotional, you know, type thing. And by the way, you did mention, you know, the seller kind of quits or disengages early. Got to stay on top of that all the time because that temptation could be there. Hey, I signed up a business broker so I can go to Tahiti in 6 months. Yes, the transaction has closed. You absolutely may. if it hasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And where, because I hear stories on both sides of the fence, which is a business owner approaches a business program and a advisor or starts that process because they're done. Either they're done, they want to retire, they're done, they're burnt out, they're done mm-hmm. playing the game, whatever it is. And then it's just like a downward slope of the business, the yeah. focus, the revenue, the being on top of it versus doing it years in advance and making sure that everything's in line. Mm-hmm. Like, where are you seeing any trends where business owners are preparing more or engaging with a broker sooner or earlier since you've been doing this? Or is it always random?
Yeah, I would say it's always random. It's always nicer and easier when a seller is like, hey, you know, I'm ready to sell today, but I know that it could take a long time. There'll be things I could do to improve it. And by the way, if you look at our current batch of sellers at the Vant Group, we may have had a conversation with them 3 years ago, you know, and that's okay because, you know, we've helped them with things they could do so that when they come, they're ready, you know, and things of that nature. But yeah, I don't know if there's a trend to it because there are also some, it's like, man, I'm just done. You know, help me sell my business. And I got to tell them like, okay, the sell process is a bit of a marathon. You know, it is a long and exhaustive process and you do have to stay engaged through it and things of that nature. And if I could go slightly darker, you know, we do get the, hey man, our dad passed away last week. You know, we now have the business. We don't know how to run it. You know, can you help us? You know, and those really turn into catching a falling knife as quickly as possible. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you do in that mode? What expectation can you set? Hopefully the people who inherited it are realistic that they're, you know, don't know how to drive this ship that might hit an iceberg.
Yeah, exactly. And that's going to be very situational. And that's where kind of that broad experience, not just in operations, but in M&A come into place. You know, like, okay, how long ago did he pass away? Are the employees still there? Is there anybody who's kind of an informal leader that we can rely on? Because look, I mean, you know, a business where a business owner has passed away, you know, it does have an expiration date on it. You know, it's like milk in your fridge. And the sooner you can get things moving and get stuff in place, the better you're going to be. And then I have to be super careful on the marketing side to a buyer. You know, a buyer may be tempted like, hey, let me let this milk spoil a little bit and get a better deal. And it's like, dude, you don't want the spoiled milk. And yeah, and we can talk, you know, maybe the next question in terms of the ratio of buyers out there looking versus businesses for sale. We're very good at getting multiple buyers looking at deals. So if I think, hey, you're a serious buyer, but you may be trying to run the clock out, I'm going to talk to the other 14 guys who inquired about it this week, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's from what I've seen, the general trend is there's a lot more buyers than there are inventory, especially of good businesses that are worth buying at the price mm-hmm. they're being listed for.
Yeah. 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 No, I think that's absolutely true. And people ask me about that dynamic, you know, well, is it always like that? I would say since 2009, it's been that way since the global economic crisis. And the only reason why I use that as a yardstick is that's really when I kind of started getting into the M&A space. I was an operator at a privately held company, regional VP, had half the divisions, and our owner said, hey, take the business into the sell process. You know, we did 24 manager presentations my last year, and this was 2009. And it was absolutely begging people to come look at our business, you know, to buy this company. And, you know, yada, yada, I went and did another operations role, 7-Eleven, in fact, it was in an operation role there and then got an M&A after that. And it's like, wow, you know, things are completely opposite, you know, and that's where I kind of see that it started where there's way more buyers out there than you said, good quality inventory of decent businesses.
Yeah. And the buyer's always looking for a gem and a deal and something that, you know, is just going to make easy mailbox money for them. Not all the buyers, but a lot of them. And of course, that's just not out there.
For sure. And by the way, you know, and I can support that mindset, you know, from a buyer. It's like, hey, you want a gem that you're going to be able to make a very successful go at it. Awesome. Let's do this. But if you're going to try to leverage that into, you know, you get it at a lower than market price, absolutely not. I'm going to show this gem to a couple hundred other people.
Yeah. And where, you know, my mind thinks of real estate examples, but thinking of like, okay, there might be a gem out there that might have some quick, you know, easy to the right person upside potential to increase its value. but you're not going to get it for a steal, right? So it's worth this. The market value says this. If you do a few things, you can get it to here really quick and easy, right? Like buying a house with an unfinished basement and finishing the basement. Now it's worth more, but like the market value is what it is.
Yeah. You know, and that's a good point, right? And that, and it's a truism that I have to always be comfortable with. So just like, you know, if I have a business and I have to defend against the buyers that are trying to do this, I'm like, nope, it's here. I also have to defend myself and the seller from, oh, well, if it's worth this, see if you can get this. And it's like, nah, it doesn't really work that way. There's some exceptions, you know?
Yeah, you got to be careful with that mode of like, well, if we get an offer really quick, it must have been worth more and we should have waited. But like the market will tell you what it's worth and you just have to.
Yeah. Sure. And by the way, and then and that gets into a little bit of the difference in our approach, right? So a lot of people think that, hey, a business is worth what the marketplace says it's worth. Okay, well, what does that mean in practicality? Okay, let's offer the business and see what the market says, you know, and then be surprised and choose to be okay with it or not. We take the opposite approach, like, no, before we even bring it into market, we're going to freaking wrestle, you know, with all the analysis, pull comparables, look at bankability, and then tell the seller, here's what you can expect. Are you okay with it? Yeah, I think I am, but can you get me a couple million more? Nope. Well, I'm going to go to another guy who says he can, okay. You know, and honestly, we get some of those people back a couple of years later. Yeah, I guess you were right. You know, and it's not an arrogant thing. It's just what the numbers are, you know?
Right. And you know, we here at the Business Broker Growth generally deal with brokers who have lots of experience and do that evaluation side, right? Versus mm-hmm. another topic we'll talk about in a few minutes of some of the other side of business broker, just business broker, not there. But yeah, that effort put into the value where, you know, the value from an analyst standpoint, not just a, let's just put it up there and see what happens, right? Yeah. Which is important. And then dealing with the right seller, you know, who understands that.
Yep. Exactly.
So one of the things shifting a little bit, I know that what you've told me in the past is, you know, a challenge that you have with sellers. And I know this to be true as well. I've seen this so many times is they've done everything probably on their own or with a small group of people, but mostly on their own, to get to where they are now. And they think, well, if I've built this and I've done this and I've been running this for X number of years or decades, I should just be able to sell this myself as well, right? I'll just take care of this myself because I've been able to solve every other problem I've ever had, mm-hmm. you know, with maybe grit and persistence and whatever. And so how over the years since you started in this, how have you, you know, looked at, or what have you guys done that's been successful at getting in front of sellers to help tell them the story of, you know, the type of work that you can do for them?
Okay. Yeah. No, that's a great question. Yeah. Because I think you're right. I mean, I think a lot of people come to it, like you said, I figured everything else out and I've even been selling stuff out of my business, right? So selling my business, you know, should be pretty easy, you know, and at the core of it, you know, the M&A process, you know, I always tell people, look, there's no calculus in it. You know, there's no rocket science to it, but it can be, you know, pretty complex. And there's multiple moving parts to it too. You know, there's the deal and the price itself and matching a buyer to your business, you know, what the value is and of it and things of that nature. But then there's going to be the deep due diligence that they're going to do. And, you know, how do you support their due diligence requests without oversharing something that's going too early, that's going to harm you. And, you know, are you even able to produce the reports that they think they need to be able to evaluate your business? And then the buyer is going to have a financing problem. You know, they're going to have to get the money from somewhere. Because look, I have sellers tell me all the time, it's like, hey, don't bring me anybody that needs to borrow the money. You know, my business is worth $5 million. Bring me the guy who has $5 million cash. I don't want him to have to go borrow it. I'm like, hey, that guy doesn't exist. Like, what do you mean? Of course there's people with $5 million. Oh, I know. But they're going to put that as a down payment on a $50 million business, not yours. You know, so they're, but you know, they're going to have to get the money from, if it's a corporate buyer, you know, from their finance or treasury committee. If it's a private equity group, you know, the general partners and the limited partners are going to have to be okay with it. If it's an individual buyer, a search fund, it may have to be an SBA loan. You know, I have to know all of those rules for all of those challenges. And I'll hear it, you know, about on every deal. It's like, why are we spending time on this? It's the buyer's problem. It's like, well, if the buyer doesn't get the money, it's our problem. You know, so that's why I'm helping him, you know, throughout those pieces. And I think people, you know, miss a lot of those aspects. And because, you know, sellers really only do this once in their life, you know, there's other tricks and things that, you know, that can come at you. So in that scenario where, hey, I'm going to sell my own business, you know, this guy from Something Tree Capital and Partners called me up and says he wants to buy our business. And it's like, hey, great. You know, he tells me, you know, that we're looking at this. We got an LOI. We're good to go. And then 2 months down the road, like, oh, we haven't talked about working capital. You know, you need to include this many hundreds of thousands of dollars in working capital. Like, well, why? You know, it's like, well, that's just the way it's normally done. And I guess what I'm getting at is buyers will often be more sophisticated than sellers who are just like wanting to try it. You know, if they're not deal professionals, they may hire deal professionals on their side to help them with it. And then another trick you'll see the night before close, like, hey, I know we didn't talk about the allocation of the purchase price, you know, in this asset purchase we're doing. We want to allocate the purchase price in these categories. And the seller may think, does it change the amount you're going to give me? No. It just has something to do with the taxes. Okay. No problem.
Yeah.
and a seller can't know that stuff unless they've been burned by it. Right. And then by the time you're burned by it, back to the no mulligans, you know, it's too late. Yeah. And then, so I guess the real question you asked me is, how do I deal with that? Man, I don't know. I try to explain it, you know, try to tell people, look, we do get people who come to us or we approach and they're like, I don't need you guys. You know, Jimmy from Something Tree Capital says, I got a deal. I don't need a business broker. And then I'll check on him 6 months later, like, hey man, how'd it go? You know, are you retired now? It's like, oh yeah, this happened and you couldn't get the funding. And okay, now would you like to use the Vant Group? Okay.
And it's tough, right? Because, you know, I know, again, business owners, most of them started it themselves. They've always figured it out. They've always found a way. So they figure this is another problem just to solve. And then there's always that aspect for some business owners and some people out there. It was like, why would I want to pay a broker the commission?
Yes.
I can just do it myself. That's a lot of money, right?
It is.
And it's like, okay, but what are you getting in exchange for that commission you're paying out as far as like a professional guide or an experienced guide in the process?
Yeah. You just made me think of two more topics and we can talk about later if you want. One of them, there's a psychological mindset behind debt because, you know, you mentioned, you know, started the business decades ago. A lot of those guys I talked to, it's like, I haven't had debt in 15 years. And then, so when I'm talking to him about a buyer that's going to buy the business using debt, you know, sometimes it's a little bit of a brain, whoa, you know, so, you know, we could talk about it later on if you want to. And then, I can't remember what the other thing is you made me think of.
let's talk about the debt, right? Because I think that's fascinating to think of, you know, let's say this business owner, if we go stereotypical, it's a baby boomer that never had debt, didn't believe in debt, built it from the bottom, just kept.
Or maybe when they started, they had debt and it was brutal and they never want to go there again. Sorry, go ahead. Yep.
Right. That could be as well. Right. And so their view on debt is that that's not a good thing. And that somebody that needs to take on debt isn't the right buyer for the business. Mm-hmm. Right. You seeing that?
Yeah. And that's why I'll tell people early on, it's like, hey, just so you know, 95% of the people who are buying businesses are going to use other people's money to do it. You know, they're going to borrow to do it. And it's like, man, why would they do that? And, you know, that sort of thing. I said, well, look, let's look at it a different way. You know, an SBA loan, you know, it's usually prime or prime plus a couple points, you know, so what that's like between 6-something and, you know, and 10%. If I'm going out to buy a business and I can't deliver more than 10% in value, I shouldn't be buying a business, right? And so that's really the mindset they're kind of coming at it. You know, they know that, and a buyer slash borrower may be looking at, you know, their return on investment of, hey, you know, yeah, I have to put this down payment, but I'm getting a huge return on that down payment I'm making. And then the cost of servicing the debt, it's just like, well, it just kind of comes out of the business and, you know, and that sort of thing. But yeah, it does oftentimes throw people for a loop, especially that, you know, baby boomer, not have debt. Why am I talking to this 27-year-old guy who's, you know, borrowing money to do it? Oh, and the other thing that you made me think of is, you know, why would I pay a business broker? And that's probably, and it relates to kind of our approach versus a lot of M&A advisors' approaches is, you know, so a seller, you know, they first have to get over the hurdle of paying a success fee on the back end. You know, they got to get cool with that. And then they'll say, hey, man, do I really have to pay you a retainer up front? It's like, yeah, you do. And here's what we're going to do. You know, we're going to use that retainer. You know, yeah, there's a little bit of the skin in the game that you're serious, but really we put it into that upfront work to say, okay, here's your 100-page report that says what your business is worth. And if the seller says, hey, I was talking to this other business broker that they don't need an upfront fee, it's like, well, they're not going to do the upfront work. And like I said, not criticizing that approach, but to be successful in that environment of selling, say, 20 deals a year, you're going to have to take on a couple hundred clients and put them on the market. You can't do that upfront analysis. You know, we're going to have about, you know, maybe 30 clients at one time with 20 of them selling each year, you know, the other 10 roll over into the next year, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And where, you know, which this then goes into the other topic, which I've been waiting for us to chat about, is, you know, the general success of businesses that sell versus, you know, don't sell and don't go through transactions, and where there's what seems like a very small percentage of brokerage offices and or individuals out there who have a really high success rate, right? If they list 10 properties, 10 businesses, they're going to sell 10, they're going to sell 9, right? They're going to have high success rate, you know, obviously qualifying, making sure evaluation, everyone agrees, let's go. Yep. Versus, you know, a higher failure rate in the market in general of business exits, which then leads into a term that you have for what I refer to as the used car brokers out there. So there's the professionals, and this is a weird thing in your business that's fascinating to me, where there's very little regulation. Only certain states actually require you to have something of a license, but it's usually under real estate.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the states, like literally somebody could just call themselves a business broker tomorrow and then help somebody get, you know, exit their business. And then, you know, there's the used car brokers, which is just the people who are in it, want to make money, don't really care what happens, playing the numbers game. And you have some thoughts and feelings about that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And in business school, what you just described, they call that low barriers to entry. You know, like you and I, when we hang up, we can hang up our shingle and, you know, start our own business broker firm. And it seems lucrative. It seems appealing. You know, there's a lot of aspects to it that you know, that really resonate with people's personality. There's the wheeling and the dealing and the excitement of it. You know, that could pull people into it. You know, on the more, you know, lighter positive side of it, you know, the work that you do in the M&A world, it's life-changing. You know, you're taking somebody and giving them life-changing money so they can retire for them and their family. And the buyer who may have come out of, you know, being in a cubicle for 15 years of into business ownership, you know, it's life-changing for them too. So it's, man, there's a lot that, you know, gets me up in the morning about doing this business. But yeah, it attracts a lot of people. And I think people come into it thinking like, hey, wheeling and dealing, and, you know, maybe I have a seller who's got some environmental issue or has this problem, I'll just like not tell anybody about it, you know, get a really good deal, get my commission, and I'm out of here. But the M&A process itself, there's so many, you know, trade-offs and safety checks and yings and yangs. And, you know, if you do try to conceal something, it's going to come out, you know, and the deal's either going to get retraded or not happen and things of that nature. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, just as an industry, we do have kind of a sleazy reputation. You know, in the Vant Group, you know, the term we use is like, oh, that guy's a business broker. You know, it's like, you know, we all know what that means. You know, it means, you know, rather than being a business broker or an M&A professional, you know, he's a guy, used car salesman that, hey, I'm a business broker now, you know, and because we do some buy side work, you know, so we, you know, we do see, you know, other stuff like that. But yeah, there really is an opportunity to be a differentiator if you have that level of professionalism, that honesty. And look, even if you're not an honest person by nature, you will have a compelling business interest to be honest all the way through the process, telling the owner what they can expect up front, you know, not sugarcoating it, telling what the challenges are. How do we deal with the challenges? And guess what? Challenges are going to come up later. How do we deal with those? You could be tempted to deal with a challenge in a dishonest manner, but you're going to get caught and the deal's not going to close. And you've all spent 8 months of your life. So.
Yeah. Which is tough because, you know, the business broker, which the first time you told me that I made a note, because it's just funny and just,
and it's spelled exactly as
it
sounds,
right? It's so helpful because it's just like portrays that exactly. But that kind of person is in a sales role in any industry, right? The one who's don't want to point out the negatives, don't want to give the full truth, just want to sell people either under promise or over promise, and doesn't matter, just get the deal done. The problem with this is like starting, you know, getting the sale of the business owner saying, yes, I want your help, is only the beginning of a very long process, right? Mm-hmm. You're not selling them something and never seeing them again. Like you're now starting the thing. And then like, it's, I think that's what gets people in so much trouble, is they're bringing their, those sales tactics of just closing deals to this very complicated long transaction. If you're listening to this and thinking, I need this level of authority, I just don't have time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. That's what we do here. We build that whole thing for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and the authority signals, everything we've talked about here on the podcast. So if you want to add impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it could look like for your business. Of just closing deals to this very complicated long transaction.
Yeah. And I talk about what I think is the more prevailing approach of like, hey, if I get 15 people to let me list their business, I'm going to throw them on Biz Buy Sell or Axial in the middle market, you know, what have you. And, you know, we'll let the buyers tell us what it's worth. And it kind of comes back to what you're saying a minute ago. It's like, well, if someone's saying, hey, I want to pay $7 million for this business you have listed, I might get surprised by the seller saying, man, I really wanted 10. I'm not going to do it. You know, or the buyer offers 7, the seller may be thinking, man, I only thought we were going to get 5 million, but 7 million sounds great. Okay, we're awesome. We're rocking and rolling. And then we go through the funding process and the bank is like, you guys are all crazy. It's not going to happen. You know, and then the seller was like, well, I guess the buyer needs to come up with $2 million more dollars. And then the buyer's like, I guess the seller needs to finance $2 million more. And then, you know, guess what? Yeah. It just doesn't happen.
Doesn't happen, right? It's just not a thing. All right. Well, this will continue to be the vehicle as a podcast, which I told you this in the beginning before we got here, mm-hmm. as my way to highlight people like you and the other people that brokers I deem as mm-hmm. professionals who are doing the right thing, been doing a long enough time to have the scars to prove that you can do it.
So if a business owner out there gets a hold of this podcast, you know, I invite you to look at anybody that you're thinking of selling your business and ask questions of them on multiple different aspects, you know, not just how their fee structure works, how do they do things, you know, because there's more to it than just pricing and anything.
All right. So let's move to the next section, which is the rapid growth playbook item. So this is the section where I would love to know, especially because you're 10 plus years in as we're recording this. So you guys have seen a lot. You told me you started with basically no marketing when you were part of the Vant Group and more referrals and networks and relationship, you know, evolving into some outreach, evolving into, you know, marketing strategies and under that. But I would love to know, you know, some quick tips, some items that you have found that have led to success for yourself, for the whole group, you know, that fall under like how to grow mm-hmm. the business, right? To not just be doing one or two, but doing many and, you know, whatever that looks like for you. So what's the first one? Not in maybe not in any particular order. Maybe this is an order of priority, but like the first one on that.
You mentioned the marketing piece and that is the toughest part of actually getting in front of a potential seller at a time in their life when they're ready to have the conversation and are serious about it and ready to listen. And then when you do get a chance to get in front of them, you should be very disciplined about how you manage your pipeline. You know, how frequently are you following up with them? You know, not too frequently that you drive them crazy. You know, if you're getting a vibe that, hey, I know I told you a month ago I want to sell, but something happened I can't tell you about. Okay, maybe you deliberately follow up with them 6 months from now, but be disciplined about it so you don't forget to follow up with them. So effectively managing your funnel and your pipeline is hugely important. So.
And obviously going with that as some kind of system. It's weird that I still encounter brokers. I'll talk to somebody where no system, maybe a spreadsheet, maybe not a spreadsheet, calendar, email, stack of business cards.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But you know, you can go all the way CRM crazy with a Salesforce, you know, type thing, which is not a bad idea, you know, to your point. Yeah. Just like, just random calls, but yeah. And we do something very similar within the Vant Group. You know, we handle our pipeline in a very CRM-y kind of way. And it's important to not only for yourself as the individual M&A advisor, but even your management team. You know, they need to be able to know that, okay, are you working your leads? Because, you know, depending on the way you're set up in your brokerage agency, you know, if the house is getting leads, you know, you want it to be easy for the house to be confident in giving you the leads, you know, versus one of your colleagues, you know, because you follow up on them, you know, the other guy doesn't, you know.
because any lead has a cost to it, right? You may think, oh, well, there's no cost because this lead came through the website, but there's some cost of everything that goes into that website and the business and the branding. And so there's always a cost for that lead and you want some kind of return on it. So that's a great tip. So follow up on your pipeline, especially like you said earlier in the conversation, might be dealing with people right now, you specifically, that you spoke with 3 years ago.
Absolutely.
And so you can't just take that person from 3 years ago, hope that they call you back or just randomly reach out. That would be like planting a seed in the garden and then randomly checking in on it every 3 months. And then should I do this? And then like hoping, you know, are we going to eat anything in
three years? Yeah. And especially up front too, because you mentioned, you know, a lead coming to your firm's website. It does happen. But when someone comes to a business broker's website, they're probably going to three of them, you know, and if you're not the guy that calls them back and really gets their attention, I'll call them next week. Oh, dude, I signed up with, you know, Jimmy's brokerage house, you know.
Yeah. And that's an interesting side note too, is that if somebody is going to your website, they are in that shopping mode. They are looking to buy, right? In this case here, you know, get the help of a broker. But people have very low tolerance for not getting a response, or they're just going to try different things because they don't know who they're going to like and trust. And then generally whoever says something first is the one that's going to win. So the person they build that rapport and relationship with first is probably going to get the business. So in other realms, we call that speed to lead. That is super critical.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
All right. Number two on your list.
What was that? Speak the truth as early and often as possible. Yeah. I mean, there's no benefit to holding something back or trying to cover something up because it's going to be discovered. Like I mentioned before about the environmental issue, or customer concentration is a big one. You know, don't ask me to conceal the fact that you have one customer that's 50% of your business. A, the buyer is going to ask about it. Their banker is certainly going to ask about it. And look, there's some SBA lenders even that, hey, we just won't do loans on businesses that have that kind of customer concentration. But there's a million opportunities to try to conceal and hide something, and probably 900,000 of them are going to get caught anyway. So let's just talk about up front, you know, how does this impact your value and the sellability of your business so we can deal with it, you know? And if there's nothing we can do about it and it means this difference in price, let's just agree to be okay with it or not yet, and then talk again in a year or two.
It's tough because, you know, some people, their nature is to not share those things or keep those private and hope they just never come out. The challenge is you do enough transactions, you do enough sales type things, those things will pop up usually at the last minute and then just destroy a whole deal and waste a lot of time and relationships, just destroy all kinds of things.
Yep, exactly.
All right, so speak the truth as early and often as possible. I love that. How about number three? Do you have a third one on the list?
Yeah, let me see here. It's be a solution guy versus a problem guy. Because look, you know, deals, they come with so much, you know, lint on them, and just stuff can happen and things change and problems arise. And what do we do about it? You know, I mean, like right now I have a transaction where, you know, it's an SBA loan. You know, the bank is saying we want the seller note, you know, to stand by for a longer period of time than any of us anticipated. You know, and I don't know what the answer is going to be out of this, you know, but what do we do about it? You know, the seller doesn't like it. The buyer isn't crazy about it. You know, so what are the other things that you can do? So like in past instances of something like that of, okay, well, what does it mean in this particular seller note case? You know, is it going to stretch out longer and live longer? Is the bank requiring a standby period for now, but is there a mechanism where the buyer can go to the bank after a year and get approval to start paying if the business is going well? You know, those sorts of things. It's just, you know, how do we deal with this issue that's popped up? You got to be open-minded about that. You got to be honest about it. You know, you can't, you know, I can't go back and promise my seller, hey, don't worry about it. Just keep progressing towards close. We'll deal with it later. No, we've got to deal with it. You know, we've got to fix it. You know, other instances, you know, a key customer quit, you know, or something like that. You have to be the guy that is ready, you know, in a very open and honest, open-minded kind of way of how to deal with problems. And oh, by the way, you know, that example that I just talked about, it's in a post LOI phase, right? So I'm already in a situation where I'm talking to both sides. My role switched from, hey, I'm representing the seller, trying to get the best deal to lock in that deal. So now my role switched to helping everybody get through the due diligence and close process. You know, so I can't just talk to my seller about what do we want to do? You know, how do we want this to go? Because the buyer's got to be cool with it. And then in this case, the bank's got to be cool with it as well.
Yeah, I love that. Be a solution guy versus a problem guy. I think I'm always in that mode, right? Like anything is possible. There's a solution for anything. You just got to figure it out.
Yeah. Early in my civilian career, because I was in the Air Force. It was my first job out of undergrad. And when I was at Dell Computers in a manufacturing role, one of my bosses was a former Army guy. And he was like, hey, did you ever study, you know, Normandy? I was like, yeah, I know about the Normandy invasion. Well, you know, what about it? He said, did you know that we landed at the wrong place? And, you know, this other stuff, you know, landed somewhere else. And he said, it was a crap show. I was like, really? I didn't know that. You know, and, you know, if you study kind of militaries around the world, I'm not going kind of far afield, you know, Americans in general are famous for, hey, we got this problem. You know, here we are, we're going to fix it. Another real quick military analogy, when the Allies landed on Normandy and they got into the, you know, the backcountry away from the beach, there were these hedgerows, which are just like really thick bushes. And the soldiers trained with hedgerows in England, and the hedgerows in England are like 3 feet tall. From aerial photos, the hedgerows in France looked like they were about the same, but when they got there, these things were 10 feet tall. And so you imagine a unit on the ground, you cut through a hedgerow, you're in a field, okay, no Germans here. Okay, let's go through this next hedgerow. There's 50 Germans, you know, and that ended badly. And supposedly some soldier was a farm guy from like Iowa who went to, you know, the colonel or whatever and said, hey, why don't we get some corn cutters? It's like, what are you talking about? And so they actually ordered some John Deere corn cutters, had them delivered to Normandy, and they welded these things on the front of the tanks. And you may have seen pictures of these tanks with this like agricultural thing on the front of them. So some private came up with the idea of like, drive the tank up to the next hedgerow. Oh, yeah, there's 50 Germans here, but we're in a tank.
Wow.
But anyway, yes, that has stuck with me for decades. And I try to keep that spirit, that American inventiveness spirit, even on deals.
Yeah. And again, love that. And the other part, which is the absolute truth, is that the deal is going to create its own problems, right?
Absolutely.
Problems are going 100%. To come. Obstacles, barriers, you can call them whatever you'd like if you don't like the word problems. But something unexpected and unwanted is going to happen on its own, no matter how much you're prepared. I think the Mike Tyson quote comes to mind, which is
that's right.
Until they get punched in the face, right? Like it's going to happen. And then it's about, can you just find a solution?
Yeah. And just as a side note, I mean, you know, we often joke that there's all kinds of deal killers. So if you think about a deal, there's not just the buyer and the seller, you know, we've talked about the bank, you know, but there's lawyers in it too, you know, and a lawyer can be a deal killer. You know, if a client wants to do the deal and has agreed to the stuff and their lawyer's like, man, I would never agree to something like that. And if he's saying that about something that's super common in an M&A deal, like signing a non-compete agreement, that lawyer can tank the deal, you know, if the seller isn't comfortable making their own business decision. So yeah, man, always got to be on alert.
always. All right. So that was number three. What about a fourth one?
I would say a good fourth one is, know your craft and everything about your craft. And I would say the more you know about business also, you know, so I'm fortunate, you know, that I had my operations, business leadership, had my own business accounting. I have all those tools in my toolbox, which help me deal with things in M&A deals. But you have to absolutely know, and let's say you don't have that. Let's say you're just, you know, your first job in your career is going to be M&A. Know everything about it, because that's going to help you deal with deal problems. You know, having that collection of cases in your mind of, hey, okay, I remember the last time we had this issue. Here's how we solved it. Because you have to be a solution guy for your client, the seller, but also to help the buyer over any kind of hurdles that they see. You know, the more you know your craft and what all the possibilities are, the better. And the flip side of that too is knowing the rules. You know, so for example, in an SBA deal, There are things that SBA allows and doesn't, you know. So if that we're worried about a customer concentration issue and some customers are going to quit, man, maybe we have some earnout to where, hey, if things go great, you get more money. If things don't go great, you know, you get it less. Well, the SBA doesn't allow earnouts. You just can't. So you got to know what tools you have available to you, and you can learn that from a book, but unfortunately, mostly you learn it from, hey, I have this cool idea. No, you can't do it. Oh, I have this other cool idea. Okay, you can do that.
Yeah, and it's tough, right? Because in order to succeed at something, you have to know everything about it or as much as possible, right? So for you and your experience, the operations supply chain, all that gave you a lot of experience behind the scenes of how business works so that in this realm, you can focus on it. They also say, like, if you, you know, in order to win a game, in order to, you know, even break the rules, you have to know how everything works, right? In this case here, it's like you have to understand what the structure is. And if you don't have direct experience, then you have to study like crazy or school of hard knocks, right? That's the
idea. Yeah. And I guess I'm just one of those learners. You know, I did okay in school, but, you know, I learned by doing more than I learned by reading.
And that's how we are as humans. Most people, like, you can only read so much, then you have to apply it. And it's interesting how many times on the podcast your guests, you know, bring up that, like, studying, getting certificates, learning, always learning, always trying to understand business, the market, the rules, lending, you know, all of that so that you know in that moment, right? It's like professional athletes who practice and study and practice and study so that when they're in the game in that moment, they don't have to think. They just know, right? They can react and don't have to, like, pause. Yeah. All right, number five. Do you have a fifth one?
Yeah, and it kind of rhymes with stuff that we've talked about, and it's do everything in an honest and ethical manner. And, you know, not only does it, you know, do you get burned if you try to do things, you know, dishonestly or whatever, you know, maybe you get away with it, you know, a few times. Maybe you get three deals where, like, haha, that buyer never found out about that environment, listen, until after it was over. But it's just simply not sustainable. You know, in our profession, you really only have your reputation. You know, when you're approaching a seller and say, hey, trust your entire life's work to me to get the best deal for you. And it wouldn't take much research for them to, like, you know, find out, you know, like, hey, there were three guys that, you know, he got a quick sale, but then they found out after the fact they could have gotten twice as much money for it. Yeah. You know, you got those three closings, you got those three tombstones on your shelf, you got that money, but, you know, why would the next guy, you know, trust you?
Yeah. And I'll say what's an interesting KPI that is not tracked by any broker that I know, not statistically tracked, but in their mind they know, which is the number of buyers of a business they sold come back to them and ask them to help sell that same business.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were representing the seller, the buyer came in, they did such an honest, great job of the whole transaction that 5-10 years down the road, the buyer comes back to that broker and says, you did a great job. I appreciate what you helped me buy. I would love your help.
Yeah, that's hugely important. And you can only do that by, you know, treating everybody fairly and the deals you're doing now. You know, the buyer that hey, you pulled a fast one on him, he's not coming back, you know? Here's the other thing too, is like, so before we did a lot of true marketing, you know, it was through referrals, you know, so think of that scenario that you're talking about. Yeah. You're on a transaction where you help sell a business and hey, if the buyer does, cause there's not a lot of repeat customers in this business. Well, let's say the buyer never, you know, doesn't come back because they love their business and they're gonna keep it forever. But his lawyer or, you know, her CPA, you know, that was in that deal is like, man, I was on the other side and the Vant Group was representing the seller. They did a really, really nice job. And one of my clients who just got back from Christmas break, you know, came to me and said, hey, I really love being with the grandkids. I want this to be my last business tax return. Who should I talk to? I want them immediately to say Dirk, you know, or the Vant Group, you know, without blushing. So.
That's a big testament too, right? Then you've done the right thing is that somebody who's theoretically on the opposition, on the opposition's team, you know, appreciates the work that you do. So I love those tips. I think those are great ones. So we got to follow up on your pipeline leads, maybe have a pipeline, actually track it, maybe actually follow up. I think that people will find a lot more success in that. Speak the truth as early as often, early and often. Be a solution guy. You know, again, deals create their own problems. Know your craft and everything about it, and then just do everything honestly, ethically, you know, and play the long game. And I think, you know, especially in the era of now that we live in, where you and I did not live in it at some point with the internet, is that you can't outrun a bad reputation, right?
Like, yeah. Yeah.
It does not take much for somebody that you've upset to put something online. And it's like getting pee out of a swimming pool. Like you're not getting rid of it.
Yeah. That's the internet. And don't get me wrong, it's something that it does kind of freak me out because, you know, there's opportunities for people to get mad, you know, and I'm like, you know,
And you see that. I see that with some of the brokers we work with, where they have like this one star review because somebody got mad over something that was just life. Like it's just the transaction. It wasn't intentional. It wasn't anything. Just didn't like something or didn't like how things went, but you know, it was beyond everyone's control. And so you also have to understand that, right? That just happens.
It was funny you mentioned that. We had a one-star review for a while, but back to the pipeline, if you read his review, it's like, they kept emailing me and I didn't want them to email me anymore. And I told them to stop emailing me. Okay, yeah, we should not have done that.
You know, what's fascinating on that as a funny side note is that if you have all five-star reviews, people don't trust that, right? Like,
really?
If it's all five stars, I'm like, okay, that's not the case. If there's one stars, I think those people are just crazy. Like they just didn't understand what they're buying. It's really the 2, 3s, and 4s that will give you the, like the valuable things, which is this was good except for this thing. And then that's where you can learn about a product or a service. And so it's funny how those one-star reviews can actually help, because it's like, okay, you know, it's not all just their friends and family, you know, giving them five stars. Like this is
real. No, that's a good point. Yeah, because I guess, you know, whenever I go to Amazon or Lowe's and I'm looking for something, I'll look at the most recent, I'll look at the fives, and I'll go down to the ones and, you know.
And again, the fives are perfect. Okay, I don't care what you think. The ones are, everything was terrible. It's okay. I don't care what you think, because maybe it was you or a defect. Yeah. I want to know the 2s, 3s, and 4s, right? I want to know those people in the middle, because that's going to be more honest of, you know, I would have given it more, but this was the offset. So
yeah, just a real quick point. I mean, that's good when we're talking about referrals. And I said, you know, take care of your referrals, because think about that. You know, someone's making a buying decision. They're looking at the websites and they're looking at the Google reviews. But if their CPA can say, no, I was in the room, you know, when they did this other thing, and here's what I saw, that, do whatever you need to do to make sure that person refers you.
Yeah, all day, right? And that's the thing with this is what we work on a lot on our side. But, you know, with the internet being so noisy, it's tough to just truly go with a Google search, like we were talking about earlier, with like filling out a form on some websites. Very few people are going to do that. Most people are in this day and age are going to go, there's so much noise online. Who do I know? Who do I trust? That's going to help me make the right decision on something this big, right? We're not talking about a new couch. We're talking about potentially once in a lifetime business exit.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. No mulligans.
No mulligans. All right. Speaking of which, let's go to the next section here. The last section I love to cover, which is the deal that got away. So there's always those lessons from a lost deal where a deal that should have happened, it could have happened, it didn't. And you know, what the lesson, what was learned from it, or what could be a cautionary tale for other people. So I know that you've, you know, over the years, you have enough experience that you've had these. What comes to mind as something you want to share in that, you know, that lesson?
Yeah, I guess for me, it's not so much a deal that we were working a deal and the deal got away, you know, because this is going to sound really cocky. I mean, that doesn't happen that much to us just because we do the work up front. Right. But The one that stuck in my craw for years is the lead that got away. And, you know, in this one, it was a manufacturing company. The father had passed away. The son was running the business on behalf of the family and got introduced somehow. And, so when you're managing leads, it's really about managing your time, right? And one of the rules that we use is, you know, try to maximize your time and exposure to somebody. But there was this, I really wanted this business. And so I drove to their location like twice and three times and met with the guy and met with his mom. And I was like, man, I'm pulling out all the stops. I'm going to get this listing. And yada, yada, the dude just went cold. And, you know, I kept following up like I should. And then it was like, oh, we decided to go with another firm. I was like, you got to be kidding me, man. What happened? You know? And so I kind of broke my own rules of like, you know, eating up more time than a lead should have been worth, because I was really emotionally invested in doing it. Now the guy ended up going with with another firm. It didn't work out. You know, a couple years later, you know, they because there was some stuff going on in the business, they got that turnaround, forgot who we were, you know, went to another firm and they ended up selling. And then, man, I hope he doesn't hear this. And then a few months ago, he shows up at the Vant Group after they sold their business. And he's like, hey, I'm young enough. I want to do something else. I really love the M&A thing. I'd like to come join the Vant Group. And so now he's a colleague, and man, we get along great. You know, he's a veteran as well. You know, so we love talking about all kinds of stuff. He's he's doing super well. Even though he's in his rookie year, but man, when we get in a seminar with business owners, he's able to talk about like hey man, you know, this is my experience in selling my business. You know, here are the things that went well for me. Here's the experience I have. And just a all around super good guy, you know, great fit, you know, honest and everything like that. And man, just thinking about, you know, when his father passed away and then he was there running the business on behalf of the family. But yeah, I still get mad that I drove all the times to go see him. And now I see him every week.
Yeah. And I wonder, we don't have to get into it. Now just my brain's curious, like why he chose the others twice.
Well, no, they were two different firms. They were two different firms.
Right. Two different firms. So chose.
Well, great question. Groups. And as you might imagine, I drilled him about that. Yeah. So why didn't you come back to the Vant Group? He said, well, no, my CPA had done deals with this other firm and they knew them front and back. And I was like, man, I can't crack on that. You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. That's huge for the referral side, right? Because, you know, the cold introduction, the cold calling or the, you know, whatever it was that started that conversation in the beginning and then led to you pursuing versus the power of a referral or. Yep. You know, trusted partner.
But yeah, you're asking about deals that got away. I have had deals that got away in a sense, like, you know, they had a data hack and we lost 7 months and then, you know, the process took 3 years longer, but we stuck with it, you know, so it didn't get away. It just got long.
And you know, I know there's brokers out there where they've got two listings, they've got one closing, they've been in business for a year or two, their eggs are in that basket. Then that kind of scenario with the data breach happens. And now it's like, okay, when am I going to get paid?
I mean, you just reminded me of a confession that I need to make. You know, years ago, I had a couple really good back-to-back deals and had a really good year, but then kind of took my eye off the ball in managing my pipeline and then had an extremely long dry spell. you know, so lesson learned.
And I'll tell you, we see that a lot as well, where someone's just doing well or doing well enough, they're not putting effort into it. And then what happens is they're living off of the referrals that come in sporadically or the deals that close, and then but not planting new seeds in the garden, which means at some point the food's going to run out, right?
Like absolutely.
At some point it's going to get really scary and bad. And then the desperate mode kicks in with the marketing or the outreach or the partners or going to B&I meetings, you know, eight times a week to try to like revive this, you know, dead garden of a pipeline. And you just can't play that game.
Exactly. And you're going to be susceptible to the temptation of like, oh crap, I have this deal I've been working on for 8 months and this thing came up. I'm not going to tell anybody, you know, so.
Yeah. Or you're going to take the deal for the person who wants $7 million for the business that's only worth $5 million because, hey, why not? Let's try it, right? I need it.
See what happens. I'll tell you what happened.
See what happened. All right. As expected, I knew this was going to be a great conversation. I know that we have after show we're going to do. There's some more stuff that I want to get into. Dirk, this has been super fun. I knew from the first moment we chatted, I was like, okay, we're going to have a blast when we finally sit down and do this recording. As I mentioned in the beginning, we'll have all of your links in the show notes if people want to go. The website is thevantgroup.com. They can find you on LinkedIn as well, Dirk Ambrust. That will be in there. Your email will be in there. So all of that will be available. And I just appreciate you sharing all of this. I know it's a lot of information, a lot of under the hood, a lot of transparency, you know, and your genuine honesty kind of mode. I appreciate you sharing all this. And hopefully it helps, you know, the business brokers out there that hear this, that are maybe on this journey. Business owners, it's also one of my goals for this as well, is that a business owner finds this and says, okay, is Dirk the person I can trust? What do I need from a business broker? And hopefully, you know, they understand like, okay, this is this is the best way to go about it.
Well, and if I could flip that around, I'm glad you're doing this as well too. You know, we talked about the business broker and M&A advisor space. There's no barriers or entry, so you could find yourself in it. You know, and where do you get that experience? You know, so the fact that you have this is good, and I'm glad you have this. You know, the series of people can go get the information and learn it, because the alternative is to learn by mistakes with somebody's lifelong business. And gee whiz, you don't want to do that. You know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, stay tuned. We're going to do the after show again. Dirk, appreciate you being here. We will we'll sign off here in a moment. And for anyone tuning in, if you want the authority that we talked about, a lot of the things that we discussed is really important for keeping that garden growing, to making sure you have that pipeline, as Dirk mentioned, this in the growth tips and making sure that you're just always on top of it and following up with it. That's what we do at Business Broker Growth. So make sure to contact us today. You can find information. You can just Google us and go to the website and reach out. And until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.